If you don't already know, my name is Bhante Bimala Ramsey. I've been a Buddhist monk for 19 years. 12 of that was in Asia, in Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Indonesia. I've been practicing meditation for, what year is this? Five. So, 31 years. And when I started meditation, I was the manager of a fairly large store that had 25 salesmen. And after meditating for 3 or 4 months, I decided that was the right thing for me to do. So I called up the head office and said, "You better get somebody down here because I'm leaving at the end of the day." And then I decided that I was going to take a trip to India. So I got all my money together and passport, and then I went up to San Francisco and I was ready to jump on a boat. And the night before I was ready to leave, somebody stole my money and passport. So I didn't get to go. And I wound up going to San Jose at a meditation center there. And I spent a month there, and they asked if I would stay and help them. So I wound up staying there for about a year and a half. In that time, I got to meet a lot of now very famous people. Joseph Goldstein is very renowned in the Buddhist world in this country, and Jack Kornfield. And I met Joseph's teacher, who was Manindra. He was a little Indian man. And he was truly a wonderful teacher. And I got to practice with him for about a month and a half. I started studying seriously when I met my teacher, and he came from Burma and stayed in San Francisco, and I heard that he'd come and he was staying there, so I went up and I said, "Here I am," and I asked him if I could be his attendant, and he said yes. So I was his attendant for 2 years. He was a very, very famous teacher in Burma. His name was Usilananda. And his main thrust of study was Abhidhamma, which is Buddhist psychology. So that's what I got to do for a couple of years. After that, I decided I wanted to be a layman again and go out. So I started working and decided that I wanted to see if I could make $1 million in a year. And I started out by borrowing $300 and started my own construction company. And by the second year, I was building $1 million houses. And I had between 15 and 20 carpenters working for me and all of that sort of thing. And before long, the next year I built 3, and the next year there was 4. And then I started looking at that and said, okay, I can make a lot of money. I have to work too hard to do it, and I don't like that. So I said, okay. So I got a partner, and the month after I broke him in, I said, "The business is yours. I'm going to Asia." So I gave everything away and went with what I could carry in a backpack, which was way too much stuff, but still. When I got to Asia, I decided to go to a meditation center. And then I decided, well, it was coming up on the anniversary of my father's dying. So I decided that to honor him, I would become a monk for 1 year. And that was 19 years ago. I thought I could do everything that I needed to do as far as meditation in 1 year. But it got so interesting that I just kept extending. And then I went to Burma, and I was in Burma in 1988 when they had all their social unrest. And I was there for 8 months. And then the government didn't want any foreigners in the country, so they said I had to leave. And I went down to Malaysia to another meditation center, and I decided that I wanted to practice loving-kindness meditation instead of doing the street vipassana that I've been doing for so long. So I did an 8-month loving-kindness retreat. And when I talk about doing retreats, I mean, I really did retreats. Start meditating, had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, start meditating at 4. And meditated generally till around 11 at night. And that's all I did. So after about 8 months, it got time to leave. And I had no idea where I was going to go, so I went to Bangkok to see what was happening there. And I happened to meet somebody, and he said, well, I'm going, a monk, he said, I'm going to Singapore, why don't you go to Singapore? Okay, Singapore is as good a place as any, we'll see what happens there. There I happened to meet a very, very famous Thai monk, who later became world famous because of the trouble he caused in Thailand. His name was Ajahn Yantra. And I was so impressed with him. He was in Singapore for 1 week, and I was so impressed with him, I wanted to practice with him. And he was going to Australia. So I went back to Malaysia, and some supporters got a ticket for me to go to Australia. So I went to Australia, and I showed up on the doorstep, and again I said, here I am. And he was the kind of teacher where he developed your sense of patience. And he wanted to test me to see whether I was worthy of being around for a period of time. So we would eat lunch, and then he would start talking. And he would talk for 4 or 5 hours. Now, this is right after lunch, no going to the bathroom, no getting a drink of water, just sitting there. And when he saw that I could do that, he said, okay, you can stay. So I wound up staying with him for about 6 months. And then I went back to Malaysia, and some people there asked if I would start up a monastery there. So I helped them get the monastery going. They had started to get members. They had about 25 or 30 members when I first got there. And then when I decided I wanted to leave, there was over 500 members. While I was in Malaysia, which is very much, the people there are very much interested in Vipassana meditation. But I still wanted to do more meditation. And I started teaching some loving kindness because Malaysia is a very interesting country in that it's a third Chinese, a third Indian, and a third Malay. And Malay run the government. Chinese are very ambitious folks, and the Malay are rather kickback folks. So the government was continually pushing down the Chinese. And the Chinese were walking around being angry all the time. So I thought it was a real good opportunity for me to start teaching loving kindness, because I'd just gotten done doing an 8-month retreat of that. Then I went to Thailand for a 3-month range retreat with a friend of mine. He's a German monk. It was great fun to be around. And during that time, I had applied to get into Burma, and it took me 8 or 9 months to get a visa. Finally, I got a visa, and I went back to Burma, and I started doing a Vipassana retreat, and I did that for 2 years. Then I came back to Malaysia, and what I had started with loving kindness, people were becoming more and more interested in it. So I started teaching more and more of the loving kindness meditation. And became reasonably famous in Malaysia for teaching loving kindness, because I was the only one in the country that was doing it. And people were practicing different forms of meditation, and they would go real deep in their meditation, but when they got out, they still had problems with hindrances arising. And there's five different hindrances that are basically, don't sit with your arms crossed and your legs crossed, please. The hindrances are things that stop you from being in the present moment. The first is lust, greed, the I want it mine. The next one is hatred, aversion, the I don't want it mine. The next one is sloth and torpor. I'm sleepy, I'm tired, I don't want to do this, my mind is too dull right now. The next one is restlessness and remorse, or restlessness and anxiety, I think is a better word. And the last one is doubt. Now, when doubt comes up, it's not, what should I do today? It's, am I doing this? Do I really want to do this? Is this the right way? Those kind of doubts. Now, when these people were practicing their meditation, they were practicing a form of absorption meditation, when it's a one-pointed kind of concentration. And the way to explain that is, your mind is on your object of meditation, and your mind gets distracted, a thought comes in, a sound, whatever it is, your mind goes to that. Now, what the instructions are for this meditation is to see that, let it go, and come back. And your mind eventually goes very deep into your object of meditation, whatever that happens to be. For some people, it's staring at a candle. For some people, it's the breath. There's a lot of different forms of concentration like that. But the disadvantage of doing the absorption concentration is that your mind goes so deep that the force of the concentration stops the hindrances from coming up. When you get out of meditation and get back into your daily life, guess who comes for a visit? And comes back with a vengeance. Now, what was happening in Malaysia at the time was the government was really being hard on the Chinese, and that's who I was dealing with at the time. And they would go for 2 weeks or a month retreat, and they would come back from the retreat, and all of a sudden they were being nasty to all their family, and they were saying things that were very biting and hurtful. They just weren't very happy. But because I was teaching loving kindness, they would run to me and say, "I need to do a retreat with you." So they would come for a week, and then they would get balance of mind, and then they would go out. And their life was more in balance after that. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of people started coming to me, because I was teaching this. But I was not teaching a one-pointed kind of concentration. I was teaching vipassana and tranquility at the same time. Now, what's the difference? The one-pointed concentration is the distraction comes, you let it go, you come back. By studying the suttas, I found that there was a step that everybody was missing in the instructions in the suttas, and that is the Buddha taught, your mind is on your object of meditation, that's the same. Your mind gets distracted, that's the same. But instead of letting it go and immediately coming back to your object of meditation, every distraction causes tension or tightness to arise in your mind and in your body. So the extra step is to relax. Now, everybody here right now has tension in their mind, and you don't even really notice it. But if you put your attention on that little tightness, and it's like the start of a headache almost, and you relax, it's like you have a tight fist and you want to let go of that fist. How do you do that? Well, you just do it. You notice that there's tightness in your head and in your body, and you let that tightness go. You feel your mind open up like a flower opening up, and then your mind becomes very calm right after that. Your mind is very alert. There's no thoughts in your mind at that time. And you bring that mind back to your object of meditation. So adding this one extra step, it helps you to become more aware of the connection with your mind and body. You start to see more clearly how your mind begins to work. And this is part of vipassana. Vipassana means insight. You start getting insight into how your mind works. How does your mind go from being on your object of meditation over here thinking about this or that? How did that happen? One of the things with people that practice absorption concentration is they never notice that tension or tightness until they get to a certain depth in their concentration, and then they'll notice they got real tightness here. And the instructions are, if your mind goes to that, just let it go and come back to your object of meditation. It does go away eventually. With the kind of meditation that I teach, you don't get that kind of tension in your mind. You don't get that tightness because you're continually relaxing. This one extra step, in fact, changes the entire meditation. This one extra step of relaxing changes everything. Now, when I give instructions in the meditation, I tell you that you need to put your mind on the feeling of loving kindness, and you make a wish, and you feel what that wish is. The feeling of loving kindness is a warm, glowing feeling in the center of your chest, like the first time you held a baby in your arms, or a puppy or a kitten or whatever. You just have this overflowing, warm feeling coming up. That's the feeling of loving kindness. Now, when you make a wish for either your happiness or someone else's happiness, you make a wish that you sincerely want to see happen. Like, a wish, may you be peaceful and calm. Now, everybody knows what it feels like to be peaceful and calm, right? So, you feel that peace and calm, and you put that feeling in the center of your heart. And that radiates that feeling. So this loving kindness meditation, which is the main kind of meditation that I teach, although I do teach other forms of meditation, this is different from other forms of meditation in that you're working with feeling. You're not working on trying to concentrate your mind. You're working with a feeling here and keeping that feeling going. Now, part of the meditation is a lot different than other people that teach meditation, in that I know some of the Zen people will tell you, well, you just blank your mind. And that causes some difficulty with people because they don't tell you how to do it. And they wind up thinking that thoughts are the enemy and you're not supposed to have thoughts. But you always have thoughts. What you need to do is notice that your mind went to the thought, let it be, relax, come back to your object of meditation. The relaxing and coming back to your object of meditation is a thing that improves your awareness of how this process works. Now, this is a lot different from psychology. In psychology, they want to know why something happened. And in Buddhism, we don't want to know why. We don't care why. What we want to know is how. How did that happen? How did your mind go from being here, calm and peaceful and that loving feeling, to over here thinking about this or that? Or getting involved with the feeling of sadness or depression or fear or anxiety or anger, whatever it happens to pop up at that time. Now, every time there's a distraction, every time your mind goes away from your object of meditation, that is caused from one of the hindrances. And the hindrances, they don't like to do things one at a time. They kind of like to gang up on you. So you have dislike and restlessness. Now, restlessness is a big hindrance. It's probably the biggest hindrance, because every time there's a thought, it's caused by restlessness. And then there's the I like it and I don't like it mind. And all of the reasons why you like it and you don't like it. And you start thinking that, and then you're thinking this, and then you're thinking that, and then you're 1,000 miles away. So, with the meditation, thoughts are not the enemy. They're just something to let go of. Now, how do you let go of a distracting thought? You don't keep your attention on it. You let it be there. It can do anything it wants to do, but you don't have to pay attention to it. And then when you relax, there's that clear spot where there is no thought. There's just this pure awareness. And you bring that mind back to your object of meditation. So, when you're practicing loving kindness meditation, it's back to the feeling that's warm, glowing feeling in the center of your chest, and then you make another wish for the happiness of whatever form it happens to be, whatever is appropriate at the time that you can really feel. Sometimes you can wish joy, and you feel joy, and you put that in your heart. Sometimes you feel happiness, you put that in your heart. There are times when your mind is kind of muddled and kind of dull. So you make a wish for a clear mind. Now, with the loving kindness, first you start out by sending loving and kind thoughts to yourself, because you need the practice. And if you don't have the loving kindness in you, how can you give it to someone else? So you start appreciating yourself. You start sending yourself happy feeling, making that wish, keeping with that here. You don't make the wish over and 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 over like a mantra, because that turns into a form of one-pointed concentration, and you wind up doing it kind of like you memorize stuff, but you're thinking about something else. But this meditation isn't like that. This meditation is that you have to sincerely feel that wish, and then put that in your heart, and put yourself in your heart, and surround yourself with that feeling. You just make the wish one time, and you stay with that feeling as long as it you can. It will fade away. When it fades away, your mind will become distracted. You let go of the distraction, you relax, you come back, and you do it again. You can make the same wish over and over again. You can change the wish. It's up to you. It has to be a wholesome wish that you really would like to see happen. Now, there's times that restlessness can get so strong that you know the feeling that you have to do 25 things and you've got 10 minutes to do it, and you're jumping from one thing to another. Okay, that's a real strong case of restlessness. When that happens, what you need to do is sit for 5 minutes and let that feeling be and relax. Let the worry be, let the anxiety be, let the sadness be, whatever it happens to be at that time. Let it go and relax, come back, and you make a wish for a clear mind, for an alert mind, for a mind that's peaceful and calm. But each one of those wishes, you have to feel the wish, and then put that wish in your heart. Always after you make a wish, it's a good idea to relax again, because thoughts cause tension. And even though it's a very uplifting, wholesome thought, there's still some tightness there, so you relax. And you keep that feeling going as long as you can. When you're sitting in meditation, there are days when you've had a real active day, and there's been 1,000 things that had to be taken care of, and you got a lot of things on your mind, and then you say, okay, now I'm going to go sit. You can't automatically think that your mind is just going to pay attention to that. Your mind is going to keep doing what it's been doing all day. And it's okay. As soon as you notice that you're doing that, then you let it go and you relax and you come back. If your mind goes away 50 times in a sitting, and 50 times you notice it and you relax and you come back, that is a good sitting. It's not a peaceful, calm sitting, but that's what I call a work sitting, where you have to roll up your sleeves and really do some work. But every time you come back with that peaceful and calm mind, you'll start staying with your object of meditation for a little bit longer. And you won't be as distracted for such a long period of time. When you first start off, you might be sitting for two or three or four minutes and not even know that you're thinking. And then when you recognize that, that's fine. Let it be, relax, and come back. After you get practice in doing this, then your mind will start staying on your object of meditation for longer periods of time. You'll start noticing more quickly how your mind goes away. So instead of going away for 3 or 4 minutes, it might be a minute. And then after a while, it's 30 seconds, and then it's 15 seconds. But the time that you're spending on your object of meditation starts to be longer. You know, at first you might get one wish in, and all of a sudden your mind is flying away. But as you practice, it starts turning around. You start staying on your object of meditation for a little bit longer, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And as you do this, you start to get more and more a sense of how your mind moves, how your mind jumps from here to over there. It's not just a jump. It's a process that occurs. And as you become more familiar with this process, you start catching it a little bit faster. As you practice more, you get better at it. I mean, that's the same with everything, right? So, the more you're able to let go and relax and come back, the more peaceful and calm your mind will become. And the more you'll be able to recognize how these things happen. Now, this tension and tightness that arises in your mind and your body with a thought or a feeling or a sensation, this tension is what the Buddha called craving. Now, we have Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. Everybody knows about that one. There's a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is craving. There's a cessation of suffering. The cessation of suffering is the cessation of the craving. And there's the way leading to the cessation of the suffering, which is the way in which you're able to recognize the craving. Craving always manifests as tension and tightness in your mind and in your body. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. Now, according to dependent origination, which is one of the things that the Buddha taught continually, it is a process of being able to watch more and more closely how these things occur. Now, let's say, take the eye for example. That's always an easy one. In order to see, you have to have a good working eye. There has to be color and form. The eye hits the color and form, and eye consciousness arises. The meeting of these three things is called eye consciousness. Right after this contact, feeling arises. Feeling is pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Right after the feeling arises, craving arises. And that's where the tightness starts. That's the I like it, I don't like it mind. Right after that, clinging arises, and clinging is all of the story, all of the thoughts about why you like it, why you don't like it. So, when you're starting to be more familiar with how this process works, you're able to see these things a little bit more easily. You'll see a feeling arise. And then you'll see this tightness arise right after it. I mean, this is quick. I'm not talking about a long period of time. The feeling is there, the craving is there. Craving is there, the clinging is there. And there's one more part of this, and that's called the being. And the being is your habitual tendency. When this feeling arises, these thoughts arise, and they arise because that's my tendency to always act this way when this kind of feeling arises. Or when these kind of thoughts arise, or when these kind of old patterns arise. So you can see that there is a process that happens that pulls your mind away. Now the only way that you're going to be able to see this is by staying with your object of meditation and sharpening your mindfulness so that you can see how this works. Now, mindfulness is a word with Vipassana people. They use that word a lot. But it's like the word God. Everybody knows the word. Everybody has an idea about the way they think what God is, but nobody ever gives you a definition. So your idea of God and my idea of God, we're talking about, quote, the same thing, but we're not talking about the same thing at all because we don't have the same definition. So I'm going to give you a definition for mindfulness. And mindfulness is the observation of the impersonal process of dependent origination. It's the observation. This is quite a bit different than most teachers in Buddhism. They'll give you some vague description of what mindfulness is supposed to be, but they won't give you a definite, this is the definition, so I just did that for you. Another word that is very much used in the Buddhist world is wisdom. Everybody's supposed to know what wisdom is, but what is it? How do you develop your wisdom? Wisdom is gained through seeing the process of dependent origination. Wisdom is gained through understanding from your direct experience how this process works. That's what wisdom is. So these definitions that I've just given you, you're not going to hear from everybody, but they're going to use those words a lot because they're real nice spiritual words and everybody's supposed to know what it means, so why should I give you a definition? But the Buddha was very specific about how you develop your wisdom, and it's through seeing this process. Now, everything in existence has three characteristics. Everything is changing. Nothing ever is the same. It's always changing. You're a different person now than when you walked in the door, although it doesn't seem like it. But it's just like the second hand on the clock. You know, where did that second go? Well, it was here for a second and then it's gone to another second. It's changing. Everything is in a state of change. Because everything is in a state of change, It's a form of unsatisfactoriness. From time immemorial, we have been looking for ways to make things not change. And we don't like change. We want things to be happy all the time. And when they're not, it's unsatisfactory. It's a form of suffering. I want this to be this way, and it's not, and I don't like it. That's suffering. Also, when you start noticing the process of dependent origination, you start noticing that there is no permanent self. There's no permanent being. Everything that arises is part of an impersonal process. Now you say, how can that be? Well, you're sitting in meditation, very nice, peaceful, calm, staying with your object of meditation, and all of a sudden, sadness happens. Did you plan that to happen? Did you say, well, I haven't been sad for a long time, it's time to get sad now? It happened because the conditions were right for it to arise. You didn't have any control over it arising. And you can be sitting in meditation and all of a sudden a pain can arise somewhere in your body. Did you ask that pain to come up? No. But it arose because the conditions were right for it to arise at that time. What you do with what arises in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. You only have control over what happens in the present moment. And you don't, that's continually changing. When either an emotional pain or a physical pain arises, you treat him in the same way. You notice that your mind has gone to that, and you let go and relax and come back to your object of meditation. Now, let's say a physical pain. You're sitting and all of a sudden an itch arises and it's really intense. You didn't ask the itch to arise. It came up because it was time for it to come up. Now, you can dislike that, and you can try to force that pain, that itch to go away, but it only gets bigger and more intense when you do that. Now, this mental and physical process is made up of five different things. You have a physical body. You have feeling. You have perception. Perception is it's the part of the mind that names something. It's the mind that sees this and says, this is a cup. It gives names to things. It also has memory involved with it. You have thoughts and you have consciousness. Now, when this itch arises, what we try to do is think the feeling away. But it doesn't work. And the more you try to think the feeling away, the bigger and more intense the feeling becomes. So what do? The first thing you do is notice that you're thinking and let go of the thought and relax. Next, you'll notice there is a tight mental fist wrapped around that itch. And that tight mental fist is aversion. I don't like it. It's an unpleasant feeling. I want it to stop. I want it to go away. But the truth is, when a feeling arises, it's there. That's real profound, isn't it? When it's there, it's there. That's the truth. And it's the truth of the present moment. what you do with the truth in the present moment dictates what happens in the future. You can fight with the truth. You can try to control the truth. You can try to make the truth be the way you want it to be. And if you do that, you can look forward to a lot more suffering. Or you can use your mindfulness and you can see it for what it is. It's an itch. It's a painful feeling. The truth is it's there and it's all right for it to be there. It has to be all right because the truth is it's there. Anytime you try to fight with the truth, control the truth, or make the truth be the way you want it to be, you can look forward to suffering. And it will come back again and again and again. And that's the way we tend to handle all of our emotional problems, all of our physical problems. We try to control them, and it just makes them worse. So what to do? You say, okay, you're here. Fine, you can be here. It's all right for you that to be there. It has to be all right because it's the truth. It's kind of like I take a hot coal and I put it in my hand. And I say, oh, that hurts. And the way I try to get rid of it is by squeezing it. And the harder I squeeze, the more it hurts. But what I'm telling you to do is just the opposite. Allow that to be there. Let that feeling be. Relax. Come back to your object of meditation. But your mind goes right back to that pain, that sensation, that unpleasant feeling, that emotion, whatever it happens to be. Okay, then do it again. And again. And again. And again. Ad nauseum. It doesn't matter how many times your mind goes back to that itch. It matters what you do with that itch. And as you become more familiar with your mind moving away and going to that itch, you're starting to see more and more clearly this process of this happening. Now, one of two things will happen. Either the pain will go away or it won't. But if it doesn't go away, you're starting to get more and more wisdom about how this pulls your mind to it. And you're starting to see these little parts of the dependent origination. And what happens is your mind starts to develop what the Buddha called equanimity, which means mental balance. And that itch can just stay there for a real long time, but before long your mental balance is such that it's okay, it's there. And it doesn't even pull your mind to it, so you don't pay attention to it. It will go away eventually, I promise. I can say that because everything's impermanent. It's going to change. The closer you can see how your mind moves, how it moves, the more balance you have in your mind. The more balance you have in your mind, the more your mind will stay with your object of meditation. And when you stay with your object of meditation and you're distracted and you go to that and you relax and let it be and come back and you do this over and over again, you start seeing it a little bit more quickly. That your mind wants to go over there and you can see it and let go right then the distraction doesn't even arise anymore. When that happens, my mind has a very big sense of relief. And right after that, you have joy arise. Now there's five different kinds of joy according to what the Buddha said. Three kinds of joy arise for anybody at any time when the conditions are right. You have a sense of joy and it's like goosebumps. It's real quick, it's there for a moment, it fades away. The next kind of joy is very intense. It's like a flash of lightning. It's there for a moment, it's very strong, and then it fades away. The next kind of joy is like you're standing in the ocean and there's just this wave of joy that comes over. And then another wave comes over. Now these kinds of joy can happen for anybody at any time. The last two kinds of joy only arise when you're doing your mental cultivation. When you're practicing your meditation. Now this next kind of joy is called uplifting joy. And joy is a very happy feeling, and there's some excitement in your mind. It really feels good. You'll notice that your mind is very light at that time, and your body feels very light at that time. The last kind of joy doesn't happen at first. It takes a little bit more mental cultivation, and this is called all-pervading joy. It's like I take this cup and I fill it with water and I keep filling it until it overflows on all sides at the same time. There's no place that doesn't have the water coming down. That's the last kind of joy that you can experience. It's like every cell in your joy, every cell in your body is going whoopee. But it doesn't have the strong excitement that the other joys had in it. This is more of a peaceful kind of joy. Now, the thing with joy is that when the joy fades away, and it will, because everything is changing, right after that you'll feel very, very comfortable. You'll feel comfortable in your mind, you'll feel comfortable in your body. Your mind stays on your object of meditation, no effort. You can still have a distracting thought, but you catch it very quickly. You let it go, relax, and come back and just stay. You feel very strong stillness of mind. Now, what I just described to you was the first jhana. Jhana is a very misunderstood word. Jhana, for most people that practice meditation, means a kind of absorption concentration. But that's not the definition of jhana. The definition of jhana is a level or stage of understanding. What are you understanding? You're understanding how this process is working. By the time you have all of this happening, your mindfulness is reasonably sharp at that time. You're able to catch your mind when sometimes it just starts to go away and you see that and relax and let it be and come back. Now the jhana is a very, very pleasant state to be in. And one of the things that happens when you're in the jhana is no hindrances will arise at that time. But because you're not real well practiced in it, your mind gets kind of tired or distracted in one way or another. And as soon as that distraction comes up, it pulls your mind away. You're not in the jhana anymore. And now the hindrances have a chance to arise. Now the hindrances are incredibly important because that's where your attachment is. That's where your belief that these are my thoughts, these are my feelings, this is who I am. And if you remember, I said the last part of the three characteristics was the impersonal nature of everything that arises. But because of the hindrance, I like it, I don't like it, I'm dull, I'm restless, I don't know. Now, all of these have something in common. What was the first word that I used with those? I... That's where your attachment is. That's what attachment is. It's the belief that your thoughts and your feelings are yours personally. Now, when people come and practice meditation with me, I rather insist that they practice smiling. And this sounds really odd because I've been around for more than 20 years. I've been around people that have been practicing absorption, not concentration. And you see them sitting. There was one guy in particular that he had a lot of physical pain, but he had very deep concentration. And when he started sitting, his head tilted, he started gritting his teeth, the tendons in his neck got really tight, and he had a frown on his face. Now, was he being aware at that time of what his body was going through? No. His mind was so deep in the absorption that he didn't know. That doesn't happen with the kind of meditation that I'm teaching. You are aware of these things. And you can relax. Now the reason he wanted to develop this kind of concentration so he wouldn't experience the pain. But when he got out of the concentration, he started doing his daily activities. Guess who came for a visit? And the dissatisfaction and dislike and all of these other things that go along with the physical pain. When you practice the meditation, it's not to stop things from coming up. It's to observe how they come up. How did it work? One of the things with meditation that isn't talked about very much by the Buddha, but it's very, very important aspect of the meditation is curiosity. We want to see how it happened. Why it happened, we don't care. Why is sadness there? Why is anxiety there? We don't care about whys. That's a never-ending process of thinking. We don't want to get over-involved in thinking. We want to see how. How does this arise? What happens first? What happens after that? You have to be curious. And with that curiosity, you have a certain kind of enthusiasm that arises because you start actually seeing it. And it gets kind of exciting. So, the more closely you stay with your object of meditation, the easier it becomes to let go of hindrances when they arise. Now, the meditation is an all-the-time practice. It's not a just sitting and being like a stone. It's watching how your mind works all the time. When you're able to recognize while you're sitting how a hindrance arises, then when you get up in your daily activities and that hindrance arises, you start to go, ah. So you're not caught with your anger and anxiety and restlessness and all of these things for days on end because something happened back then. You start letting go of these things more and more easily, more and more quickly. And what's the result of that? You become happier. You have a more balanced mind. I've known people that when they get into a depression and they stay depressed for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, sometimes even longer. Now, I can describe to you exactly how depression arises and what you do and how you indulge in the feeling and try to control the feeling with your thoughts and how the depression gets bigger. There is an unpleasant feeling. It can be a mental feeling, it can be a physical feeling. It doesn't matter. Feeling is feeling. There are three kinds of feeling: pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. The first two are the ones that we're most concerned with right now. A pleasant feeling comes up, you want to keep it. You want it to keep going. When it fades away, then there's dissatisfaction that arises. There's a painful feeling. When it comes up, we don't want it there. We want it to stop. We want it to go away. The more you try to control that, the bigger and more intense that feeling becomes. Now, I told you that there's five aggregates that this mind and body process is made up of. You have a physical body, feeling, perception, thoughts, consciousness. The more you try to think a feeling away, the bigger and more intense the feeling becomes. What is depression? It's a painful feeling. I don't like it. I want it to stop. I don't want this feeling to be around here anymore. And then your mind goes into its habitual tendency and story about why you are like that. I'm depressed because when I was 3 years old, my mother locked me in a room. Why doesn't really matter. How this process works matters. So the first thing you have to do is recognize that you're caught by this. And then let go of the feeling. Relax. Let go of the thoughts. Relax. Allow the feeling to be there. It's a painful feeling. Fine. Doesn't matter whether it's painful or pleasant. It's there. That's the truth. Remember? So you allow that feeling to be there. But you don't have to keep your attention on it. You relax the tension and tightness. Come back to your object of meditation. Because of our old habitual tendencies, our mind is going to go back to that because we've been fighting that feeling for however many years we've been fighting it, or lifetimes as the case may be. So, the natural tendency for mind is to go back to that feeling and fight with it some more and try to control it with your thoughts. So, you allow the thoughts to be, relax. Allow the feeling to be, relax, come back to your object of meditation. And you're going to bounce back and forth for a little while because the attachment is real strong. This is me, this is who I am, I'm depressed, and that's the way I am. As you relax, you start letting go of this is who I am and I have to control it. And what happens is the equanimity, the balance of mind, starts to get stronger. So the length of time that you're caught by the depression becomes less and less and less until finally you're not depressed. With that comes relief. With the relief comes the joy. After the joy fades away, then you have this happy feeling, this very pleasant, comfortable feeling in your mind and body. Right after that, Your mind is very still and tranquil. You've developed wisdom. And that's not to say that you're not ever going to get depressed again. Your habits are that you probably will, but you won't be caught for such a long period of time before you start letting it go. So the hindrances are incredibly important to be able to recognize, and recognize our old habitual tendency of I always act this way when this happens, and you start letting that go, you start seeing the process, and you start seeing that I didn't ask this depression to come up, I didn't ask this painful feeling to be there, it came up because conditions were right. But now you have a tool to be able to let go of it. Relax, come back to your object of meditation. As you do this over a period of time, instead of being caught for 3 weeks or a month with depression, then it's only 2 weeks. And as you keep practicing, then it's only a week. And then it's only 4 days. And then it's only a couple days. And then it's only 1 day. And then it's just a few hours. But that comes from practice. The practice and the intelligence that you're developing by directly seeing this is how this works. This is the direct experience that teaches you. And it's the hindrance that is your teacher. You've got a lot of teachers, I can tell.
Lucky me.
Yeah. A lot of people, I just got an email today, somebody wrote to me and they said, I've just read some of your writing and I was wondering if you would be my teacher. And I wrote back and said, why don't you let your hindrances be your teacher? I'll be your guide. Because that's what I am. I'll ask questions. Sometimes they're real shocking. Did you look at it this way? Did you look at it that way? And it's like, oh, no, I got to go back and do that. I want to see how that one worked. You wind up teaching yourself by your own hindrances, by your own attachments. Now, when I was talking about I insist that everybody smile when they do the meditation, I mean literally. I want you to smile in your mind. I want you to smile with your eyes. Even though your eyes are closed, when you smile with your eyes, you're letting go of tension and muscles. I want you to put a little Buddha smile on your lips. And a smile in your heart. Now, the thing is, life is not very predictable. Unless you have hindrances arising all the time. That's predictable. Some days are really great, some days are not so great. That's just the way life is. Now, when you see that you have unhappy thoughts, when you have angry thoughts, when you have sad thoughts, when you have any kind of emotional things that you can think of that come up, it wants to pull your mind to that feeling and cause this whole process to happen. The I don't like it, the story, why you don't like it, your habitual tendency, and it likes to keep these things going. So when you notice that you have repeat thoughts, there's an attachment there. And the attachment is, this is me, this is who I am, I like this or I don't like that. So, what to do? The fastest way to let go of an attachment is to laugh at yourself for getting caught again. Sounds dumb, but it really works. When you're able to laugh at how you got caught by this anger, you're no longer angry. You went from, I'm mad and I don't like it, to, oh, it's only anger. Nothing. Although some people really get attached and I tell them to do all kinds of weird things so that they can really get into their suffering so that they can let go more easily. I told him he had to go take his shoe off. He did a retreat with me last year. I told him he had to take his shoe off and go kick a tree. Make your toe really hurt. You'll forget about everything else. And it made him laugh. And then he wasn't caught by it anymore, and everything was fine. When you can laugh with yourself and at yourself for being heavy, you're not heavy anymore. It changes your perspective from, I'm this and I don't like it, to, oh, it's only that. It's easy to let go of. So this is another thing that people that practice absorption concentration, their mind has a very strong tendency to get very serious. And with that serious mind is a slowness in the recognition of what's happening in the moment. And it's very slow and hard to let go of that so that you can have a balanced mind again. The advantage of having joy arise is when joy arises, your mind is very light, your mind is very alert, and it's agile. You can see how these things are working. So the more you practice joy, the more you practice smiling all the time, the easier it is to recognize when your mind is heavy. And when you do that, it's easier to let it go because you start laughing at how ridiculous, how crazy. And it's okay to be crazy because everybody is. Everybody is crazy. And I include myself in that. But when you laugh, look at how your mind feels now. You've been smiling, you laughed a little bit, your mind's alert. What's it like when you're angry? Heavy. A lot of heat, a lot of dislike. And if you can laugh at being caught by that, all of a sudden your mind is light again. And it's alert. And you say, well, this really isn't that important. With a heavy mind, a problem arises and it's a mountain in front of you. You can't see over it, you can't see around it, all you see is the problem. When you laugh and get a sense of humor about being caught by this problem, you find out it's just this little bump. It's a difference of perspective. That's part of the Eightfold Path, isn't it? The first part of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha, the translations right now are, it's right view or right understanding. But I changed that a little bit because I don't like the word right very much, because that infers that there's a wrong, and that's not quite what the Buddha had in mind. So I call it harmonious. And I call it a perspective. So when you're practicing and you have a harmonious perspective, you have a very light, agile mind. that sees things as they truly are, just an arising and passing away of phenomena. The second part of the Eightfold Path is always called right thought, and that is really a long way from what the Buddha was talking about. I call it harmonious imaging. Now, when you're practicing the meditation, I told you, you bring up a feeling, peaceful and calm, and put that feeling in your heart. You're imaging that feeling into your heart. You're feeling that feeling. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right speech. And again, I change that around a little bit, and I call it harmonious communication. And this is communication with yourself, as well as everybody else around you. One of the things that happens when people meditate, they have the idea that they're supposed to have a blank mind. And when thoughts arise, they think, oh, I'm not meditating very well, this isn't working right, and on you think about these kinds of things, and you develop a critical mind. You're not communicating with yourself very well, and you're identifying with this hard feeling of criticalness and dissatisfaction. Harmonious communication is noticing when your mind is very active. And that's okay. You don't have to criticize yourself because you had an active day. You're going to have an active mind. Some days you'll sit in meditation and your mind is completely calm. You've had a reasonably calm day and there's not a lot of things that you had to think about. And both days are equal. One's an active meditation, one's a peaceful meditation. That's what I call the candy meditation, because you've already done the work in the past to get to that candy. And the other one is an active meditation. That's what I call a work meditation. That means you've got to put out a little bit more effort to recognize it, let it be, relax, and come back. The next part of the Eightfold Path, translation is right action. And again, I don't like that translation very much, so I call it harmonious movement. Now, harmonious movement is watching the movement of mind's attention as it goes from one thing to another, and the movement of letting it be, relaxing, and coming back. Being in harmony and balance with that movement. Not judging it, not being critical about it, just seeing it for what it is. Okay, this is an active meditation, we got to do this right now, and that's fine. Don't do it. You can't ever use the meditation as a stick to beat things away. It doesn't block things from happening. It allows things to happen. And the harmonious movement is part of that allowing, letting be, relaxing, and coming back. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right livelihood. And this has always been comical to me, mainly because the first discourse that the Buddha gave, he talked a lot about the Eightfold Path, and he was talking to people about meditation. But people, they changed the definition of right livelihood to mean not to kill anything, not to sell any poisons, not to cause any harm, kill any other beings, especially if you're a farmer or something like that. You have animals that need to be killed for meat, whatever. That doesn't have anything to do with meditation. So I changed that to harmonious lifestyle. And a harmonious lifestyle is being very much involved with a harmonious movement and turning this process and the observation of this process into a habit. And that's your harmonious lifestyle. In other words, doing the practice all the time while you're walking from here to there. What are you doing with your mind? Thinking about this, thinking about that. Are you smiling? No, your mind is kind of heavy. You're caught with, I like this thought, I don't like this, I gotta do this, I don't want to do that. So the harmonious lifestyle is recognizing what you're doing all of the time in your mind and body, and relaxing, letting it be, staying with your object of meditation, smiling. The next part of the Eightfold Path is called right effort by the translations that are going around, but again I changed that one to harmonious practice. Now there's four parts of the harmonious practice. Recognizing that you have unwholesome thoughts and feelings. Letting go of those unwholesome thoughts and feelings, and smiling, relaxing. Bringing up a wholesome thought and staying with that wholesome thought. That's harmonious practice. The next part of the Eightfold Path, they call it right mindfulness, and I call it harmonious observation. That's the development of your wisdom in being able to observe how the process works. The last part of the path is called right concentration, and I really have some problems with that. Concentration, especially in this country, means one-pointed concentration. Look at how these athletes concentrate while they're doing this or that. They're not distracted at all. You read a book and somebody walks up and they say something to you, you don't even hear them. You're so absorbed into the book. It's not that kind of concentration. I don't like to use the word concentration because it's so misunderstood in this country. I've changed this to mean to be harmonious collectedness. A mind that's collected, a mind that's composed, a mind that is calm, a mind that is still. And that's what the Eightfold Path is. When you have, let's say, anger arise, and you see that you're caught by the anger, and you laugh at yourself for being angry, you have just practiced the entire Eightfold Path, and you have a different perspective, and you have a mind that's alert. You have a mind that's very agile, a mind that's uplifted, a mind that's on wholesome things. This is a lot different than what in this country right now is being taught as part of the Eightfold Path. So when you're practicing the meditation, it's a practice of practicing the entire Eightfold Path. But it's not about sitting in meditation only. It's about keeping your practice going. Watch what your mind is doing with your daily activities. Watch that tension. You get a headache. What do most people do? Run to the aspirin. I got a headache. In the last 19 years, I can remember having three headaches. in 19 years. Now, how can that be? That doesn't mean I don't have as much stress as everybody else does. It means that I've been watching, and when I start noticing that tension and tightness in my neck, back of my head, tightness up here, I start going, oh, look at that. Look at what I'm doing to myself. Nobody out there is doing it. I'm doing it to myself because there's a feeling that arose and I don't like it and I'm starting to squeeze on it. So I take a couple minutes, and every time I notice my mind is tight, I relax it. The headache goes away. The only time that didn't work was when I was sick. There was something physically wrong. It just doesn't happen that I get headaches anymore. Especially this day and age, everybody wants to blame something out there for their own unhappiness. But there's nothing out here that will cause your unhappiness. You cause your own unhappiness by not liking things the way they are, by wishing they were different than they are. Sound familiar? Not much. The whole thing about meditation is learning how to reverse that process, how to let go of these old habitual tendencies that always cause us to be unhappy, and how to start recognizing when it first starts and start letting it go and relaxing. Smiling into things. Laughing with yourself. One of the ways that you know that your spiritual progress is really starting to happen is because you stop laughing at things and you start laughing with things. Like where I'm staying right now, there's a little kitten. It's a very active little kitten. And it does some of the craziest things, and I wind up laughing just because it's so great that he can do these things. But somebody could come up and tell me a joke, and it's like, why would I laugh at something like that? That's not funny. But I laugh a lot. So what we start to notice is we start having more joy and seeing more joy as we practice the meditation. And that's how you know that you're doing it right. You don't need a, quote, teacher to tell you you have to do it this way. Teach yourself. That's what you have to do anyway. I can't tell you that you have to do 500 prostrations and then you'll be enlightened. Now, give me a break. You have to be able to watch what your own mind is doing. You have to be able to see and recognize how this process works. And as you do it, your mind becomes lighter, you become more fluid, you're more accepting of things as they come up. And that doesn't mean that if somebody is incredibly nasty to you, you don't turn around and walk away, but you can do it with a loving mind. You don't have to do it from anger. You don't have to test yourself to see whether you're as spiritually advanced as you think you ought to be. You don't have to make things difficult for yourself just to see. Those things will happen by themselves. So, the more we can practice, another thing I wanted to say was, loving kindness is loving acceptance of the present moment. if you can lovingly accept what's happening in the present moment, you have a light mind. You have an alert mind. You're right there with it. That's what leads to liberation. The more you can understand your own process and see the way it really is, the deeper your wisdom becomes, the deeper you go into the meditation, and then you have all kinds of different jhanas that can arise. You have the balance of mind to handle things. Somebody comes up to you and you walk in first thing in the morning and they read the Riot Act at your job. They're angry. You did this, you did that, we can't have that, all of these kinds of things. Now you have a choice right then. You can take their anger and make it your anger and throw your anger back at them, which is what generally happens, or not. It takes two to fight. If there's only one fighting and the other one is balanced and has compassion for that person because you know they're suffering, you know what it's like to be angry, you know what the feeling is like, but you allow the space for that person to say whatever they want, but you don't pay attention to it because that's not really what they're angry about. As you stay calm, as you stay accepting, as you stay loving towards that other person, they will calm down or they will leave. That's just the way it works. So the more practice you have, the easier life becomes. And the more lovingly you can accept whatever situation that arises. Now, I was talking, before we started, I was talking about my teacher dying. And they made him last a good month and a half longer than if they would have left him alone, because they had him on full life support and all these kinds of things. His kidneys had failed, he turned black. He was golden colored, naturally, and he turned black. I went back for the funeral. And I was one of the pallbearers, and one of the jobs I had to do, they had a very special blanket that they put over him, and I had to do that. And as I did that, I was looking at him, and I didn't even recognize him. His color was wrong. He was the kind of person that always had a smile on his face. I mean, even when he wasn't doing anything, he had a little smile on his face. And he didn't have any smile. And he was bloated, and he was black, and it was like, wow, this is really something. Anyway, we went through all of the things that you do at the funeral, and then everybody got to go up and give their final respects to him and then leave. And as I walked up, I looked down at him, and in my mind I was thinking, well, I guess this is it. You're not going to be around anymore. I'm going to miss you. I wish you well. And I'll see you again sometime. But he had a real special attachment to me. I helped him do a lot in the 2 years that I was with him. And I was kind of his protector. Anything that went wrong, I could fix it. It didn't matter whether it was with a group of people or something in the house broke or whatever. I would just go fix it. Whatever had to be done, I did it. And in my mind, I heard, "You're not through with me yet. I'm still here." And now this is I was with 50 other monks, and there was hundreds of people that were in the chapel, and we're paying our final respects, and I started smiling, and I turned around, and there's 300 sad faces, and I'm the only one that's smiling in the whole group. And I couldn't help myself, because it my mind was light. I was happy that he didn't have to suffer anymore, and now he's going to a place where he can do the things he needs to do with happiness, and that's good. So I'm sure that a lot of the people that were there, the Burmese and whatnot, they thought I was some kind of crazy. Because I wasn't sad like I was supposed to be. So that wouldn't have happened 5 years ago. There wouldn't have been that more balanced mind. But as I continue practicing on and on and on, even an unpleasant thing like somebody very dear to me, I mean, he was my father, died. Even that didn't, the sadness was there. I watched it. I saw it dissolve and go away. Then there was happiness. There was a balance of mind through this whole thing. Okay, now I've been talking for a real long time. Does anybody have any questions about what I've been talking about?
I was expecting you to say that you saw the corners of his mouth change.
Well, I wish that would have happened, but... when he had his operation, I'd gone to visit him, and he had to go to Burma. He was real weak at that time, but he had to go to Burma because he was being honored. He was being given a title that never happens to any monk before they're 80 years old, and he was 78. This is the only time in the whole history of Burma that this has ever happened. It's really a big deal. But right before he left, he made me promise him that I would be back when he came back. So I came back, and then in Burma, they'd given him an MRI and saw the tumor growing in his head. So they brought him back and did the operation. With brain tumors, even if it's really bad, the person that has the operation is in the hospital 3 days, 4 days, and then they let him go home. While he was having the operation, I was spending every night there. I'd get there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and spend all night, and then I would leave at 7 o'clock and go take some rest and then come back at 4 o'clock. And he was in the hospital for 14 days. And it was very difficult. But people were saying, oh, you're going and sleeping in his room. I didn't sleep. I was awake the whole time. Because anything that I could do for him, if he would have to get up and go to the bathroom, I would undo all of his things so he could get up and go to the bathroom, and that might happen 10 or 11 times in a night. Anyway, because of that, I was given this robe. And this is a very special robe. If you take a real close look at it, it's pieces of cloth that are that wide and they're that long and they're all sewn together. And it's not only on one side, it's on both sides. So this is the robe that when I had to leave, I had to come back because these guys were coming to do a retreat. They gave it to me in a special ceremony. And when I went for his funeral, I was gone for 4 or 5 days, I was wearing this robe, and there's 50-year monks that are coming up going, "Oh, look at this, that's a nice robe you got there." Anyway, it was a trying time, but I'm real glad I did it. And right after I got back from the funeral, there's a man that's very sensitive. It's one of our neighbors. And he sees devas and that sort of thing. And I went over to his where he worked, and I was helping him do some stuff around there. And he said, "Who's that monk behind you?" "I don't know." And one of the things that Usilananda told me was that he was going to be my guardian spirit. So I think that was him. So he didn't leave. He's here. Okay, so it's 9 o'clock. So why don't we share some merit now? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas, the mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. After every Dhamma talk, the Buddha asked that we share the merit of the talk with the devas to make them happy, and they'll protect the Dhamma that much longer. So that's why I do that. Mm-hmm.